Welcome back to episode 19 of the Amateur Theatre Podcast. Today I'm chatting to Gavin Lee and Charlotte Klein from 60 Hour Shakespeare. Way too much to go into in terms of content covered today, but a real pleasure to have them both on to talk about the company and their different roles within it. Well worth heading over to their website at 60hourshakespeare.com and also checking them out on YouTube to check out their back catalogue of interviews with various different people from within the industry. A really good educational tool. They've got a really jam-packed 2022 coming up, so well worth keeping an eye out for their three outdoor productions taking place at both the Abbey Ruins in Reading and at the Jeffsome Gardens in Leamington Spa. So sit back, get comfortable, and enjoy.
Ever Shakespeare that I watched was Hamlet with Ben Whishaw,
right?
Way back when, and I was sort of very late to the game. I didn't really like Shakespeare at all when I was at school, but as soon as I saw that production, I was really lost in it, and that was the moment for me. That was kind of the big thing. That was the shift in the ground for me, and from there on in, I was just desperate to kind of get my hands on anything I could learn about Shakespeare, and going to watch the plays and also needing to be in the same space as actors, and kind of realizing that even though I kind of have a very different side hustle, realizing that's what I was built for, or in another life, that's what I was built for. So that was game changing for me. And I remember somebody asking me, because I'm actually a lecturer at university. And I remember somebody asking me, they said, "Gavin, are you a lecturer that happens to direct, or are you a director that happens to lecture?" And I said, I'm a director that happens to lecture. but the reality of it is it's totally the other way around. So, you know, Charlotte and I have to juggle everything between having the full-time gig of doing what we do and then having the 60-hour Shakespeare on the side. So it's pretty full tilt. I don't know what Charlotte's going to say. She might totally shut me down in saying this, but for me, going online and everything that came with that was just a total shift from what we were doing before, and it was so hard, and there had been a lot of times where I was just like, no, I'm not doing it. I'm jacking it in. Like, I'm just gonna hang tight until all of this is over. And Charlotte sort of talked me into it, and there's no way that I could have even imagined or have pulled off everything that we did during the pandemic, not least because Charlotte has got an imagination visually of something that she can actually follow through on. Like, she's not just talk, she can walk the walk as well. And when you're with a director like me who has a big imagination and really just wants to be around the actors, and you've got someone like that, you just feel like really solid on your feet, you know?
Yeah.
I think I sort of just, I defined it as people that like spreadsheets and people that don't like spreadsheets. And I just happen to like spreadsheets. So then I get all the organizational things on the side, and then Gavin gets to work with the actors. But I think, you know, this has really been a partnership from day one. And, you know, I think when you are building a partnership and we don't have a massive team behind us, it's really finding what your strengths are and, you know, being able to kind of delegate and, you know, work together on different things. And I love the kind of creative vision. And I think it goes back to seeing Shakespeare on the Sound of being blown away by how visually amazing and how incredible the actors were. So I naturally kind of fit into that role as kind of being the marketer, being the person that kind of, you know, how are we going to bring this to life? And I think particularly online, as we went into this horrible time of the pandemic, which was terrible for the theatre industry, there was this amazing sense of solidarity, and there was a kind of an unexpected opportunity there. And that, you know, one of the challenges with amateur theatre is that you feel that you can't get the audiences that you need. And actually, you know, when we brought our productions online and we brought our casting calls online, I mean, the floodgates opened. We had people auditioning from Russia, from the US, from Spain, from, you know, and it was fantastic. And then with that came this audience. And in some ways, some of the challenges of, you know, producing an amateur theatre production is that you don't have a big production budget and, you know, you want to stage it and you want to do all these wonderful things. Whereas actually when we were stuck to just being, you know, in this kind of square box of Zoom and, you know, you can do a lot of kind of tricks of the eye, it kind of opened the opportunity to be even more creative and to really own a medium that had never really existed. I mean, I don't think 5 years ago, Gavin and I would have known that we would have been, you know, producing Zoom productions. Feeling very alien.
Yeah, definitely. And the weird thing about it is that you, by saying yes to it, you kind of were front runners in what was going on. In any of the kind of theatre spaces, there are very few companies that I knew that weren't just replaying old filmed footage from the stage that they had when there was a live audience in it. You guys were kind of like, and I, you know, how big my circle is. During the pandemic, I was looking for stuff to kind of digest just because of my kind of desire to watch some theatre. And there wasn't a massive amount out there. So I guess it was really good that you guys were doing it and had said yes to it. But how did you, in terms of the ethos of the company and the idea that you could do it, what was the, was it just the partnership you guys had that you just both agreed, look, sod it, we're going to do it and see where we get to, and then we'll do the second one if the first one works? Or what was it kind of like?
Gavin came up with a wonderful play on words. He was like, well, we're doing Midsummer's Night Dream. We can't do it in person. Let's do a Midsummer's Night Stream. And we're like, well, that's just too good of a name to give up. But I think Gavin was about to give a very thoughtful answer.
No, that was really it, to be fair. But sometimes you need kind of a nudge from someone, your friend or whoever it is that's in your life, to make something happen. And we, that year, we both nudged one another.
Right.
To begin with, to actually make Dream happen, I got a big nudge from Charlotte, and coming off the back of that, where both of us kind of felt like we did something very different from before, but in some ways we kind of felt like we not had messed up or anything, but we felt like we were a little bit having to kind of like dust ourselves down after from everything that we learned with Dream, because it blindsides you. It's like nothing you've ever done before. Not only did I have to kind of lose the kind of all of the artistic kind of inspiration I'd had behind why I wanted to do Dream, but I also had to worry about how we were actually going to pull this off technically and all that kind of thing. So after that, it was a question of, do we want to go again?
Yeah.
And me saying to Charlotte, yeah, like, come on, we can knock this thing out of the park now, because what we already did. But I mean, I need to be stopped, basically. After that, I said, we could actually do 60 hours, 3 days back to back, just online with six different time zones.
Because you guys are up all the time working with them and everyone else.
Yeah,
from the past all around the world. I didn't have glasses before that weekend, and now spending 60 hours looking at a screen, I was like.
But yeah, do you know what? We pulled it off. We did it. And one of the things that is my biggest memories of getting to do that was actually having an idea about the way that I wanted to direct Richard II, which was our second play online, and actually not really understanding how I was going to do it, but having that idea for the first time because it was online, which was very different from before. So we looked around, and because like you said, there wasn't a lot going on, but it was really starting to gain traction. And with Zoom, you've got that difficulty of like, how do you coalesce all of those backgrounds that you've got? Do you do it by throwing everything that you've got at a costume? Do you do something else that's visceral or aesthetic? And this is where Charlotte really kind of like kicked off with unbelievable artistic kind of license and the ability to actually follow through on it too. So for Rich II, I said, could we do something with candlelight? Just like, and in the back of my head, I'm like, no, because like, there's no way you're going to be able to do that. And Charlotte said, well, I'm just going to go off and like basically watch videos and do my homework and come back to you.
Fill myself in the dark with candles and see if it works.
Yeah, that's exactly what she did, and like make this thing a reality. And then after that, with Twelfth Night, Charlotte kind of said to us, so what about black and white? Because no one had really done anything on black and white on Zoom before. And again, that gives you more kind of, it strips back everything. So you can't really see the kind of disassociation between the different backgrounds. So we've always been a team creatively, but Charlotte was just everything when we were online.
No, I take too much credit. I think the other thing that was wonderful, and Gavin, you probably haven't got this feedback yet, but, you know, during those darker days of lockdown, particularly for actors, I mean, they're so used to being part of the family of a show or of a production. And, you know, it's very isolating to be in a flat chair, you know, where it's scary and you're not sure, or, you know, wherever you are. And, you know, one of the amazing things, not only in the way that we produce it, but is also in the way that the productions are directed. You know, with Gavin taking that time and saying, actually, we're not just going to do a live script reading on Zoom for an audience, which was done and you know, was effective. Lots of theatre groups did it. You know, Gavin spent time with each of the actors, and, you know, this wasn't just we're doing a Zoom production. This is, we're doing a production of this play. You know, we still need to do the same character work and, you know, go into the same building process as we would if we were doing it outside or in a theatre. And, you know, some of the feedback was just that, you know, during those darker days of lockdown, I mean, that meant so much to those actors to be, you know, part of that, you know, cast and doing things in the way that they were used to. And again, I think when you see how Gavin directs, it's, you know, it's a no-brainer. He's the director and I do the producer and put the frills on the end. And I think we're very lucky to have found, you know, ourselves and both have different fortes. And, you know, I never feel like we're stepping on each other's toes. We always come in with input and, you know, it builds. And, you know, I think each of us is very good at challenging the other one to say, you know, do it in candlelight. Okay, fine. Yes, we're both yes men, I think. We just say, okay, fine, we'll try it. We'll work it out and we'll do it.
That could be super dangerous, but also very creative.
Yeah, that's the process.
Yeah. And how did you, again, kind of last point, just because it just popped into my head, but how did you find, and maybe this is actually probably happens anyway, whether you're doing it online or not, but that the actors are kind of doing more work by themselves, or are they kind of still reliant on you to kind of direct, in inverted commas, given that they maybe kind of feel like they are more isolated physically from you and Charlotte, and therefore might want to take upon themselves to kind of pursue various character things that when in person might have just naturally been fed into them, and have that back and forth in person that they might not be getting. Does that make sense? If it happened at all, I guess.
I missed being able to have that thing of just having an aside with someone.
Yeah.
And that you can have that sort of relationship, because you're directing to all of them or none of them more often than not.
Yeah.
So that's very different. The other thing that's very different is that as a medium, it's not film and it's not theatre. And so a lot of what you're doing when you're directing is about marks and lighting and things like that, which I have no background in whatsoever. So that ends up tearing through a lot of energy, both with me and with the actors too.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense, I guess. And yeah, I mean... maybe again, quick question to you, Charlotte, before I do move on. How in terms of that kind of, not production value, but in terms of the fluidness of a production online, what was like, were there things maybe that could roll into the real world that you were kind of learning, or stuff that was specific to a Zoom production that you just really had to overcome pretty quick? Otherwise you were, you know, no cameras were working, people were talking over each other, and it was all just mayhem.
Well, definitely. I think there was definitely like a learning curve at the beginning, and it's very hard. Like, I'm someone that likes to have a lot of control and kind of knows what I'm doing so that I can kind of convey that confidence to maybe a nervous group of actors that are like 60 hours. But so So at the beginning, I mean, it was, you know, it was a wild west. We were sort of trying to work things out. And I really loved being able to collaborate with it. And we were very lucky in that, you know, because of the pandemic, we had some wonderful actors, you know, that normally would have been booked out for months. And, you know, they're lending their intel. We're jumping into breakout sessions. You know, we're doing very creative problem solving, which I really enjoyed. And then, you know, once we knew we did it the first time, and I think one of the wonderful things about a YouTube performance is you get the feedback as you're going. I mean, that's really Shakespearean. I mean, normally you have people throwing tomatoes and chatting, and, you know, we got this really wonderful commentary, and I encouraged all the actors to go back and watch it, because, you know, that there were really, you know, there was a whole conversation with people from all over the world going, oh my goodness, you know, can you believe? I mean, I was sort of community managing, so it was like, you know, whose team are you on? Like, who are you rooting for? So there's that wonderful kind of element of collaboration. There was also a wonderful amount of feedback that we got from people just, you know, saying thank you so much for offering this, or, you know, giving bits and pieces. But I also found that I got a lot more production control over the, you know, even though it was a Zoom and very restrictive, is that, you know, some of the shots looked like they're massive, big budget, almost cinematic shots, just in the way that we were able to capture it and frame it. And, you know, I think that's one of the takeaways that I'm sort of, you know, as we go back into, you know, productions in the flesh, is, you know, you don't have that same element of control where you can control all of the factors. You know, the audience is not going to just be looking at the person that's speaking. They're going to be looking at, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually. Yeah.
So, and obviously we're not working, you know, I joked on another interview that, you know, I did a tutorial on how to make a tea towel look like a medieval kind of, you know, like a sort of headdress. And one of the reasons we did black and white was because, you know, the other productions, someone goes, oh, I've got this really good shirt, kind of looks period, but it's bright pink. And I'm like, well, that's just never going to work. But black and white, you know, hides all number of sins. So, yeah, so it's going to be, as we said, we did a small cast for Romeo and Juliet. We were able to get a wonderful, you know, costume with support of the, you know, Royal Shakespeare Company. But, you know, as we go into this world, it is, you know, I'm not going to have as much production control. You know, we've got to frame it for the setting and the environment and the elements as well. We didn't have to worry about it raining, you know, in our home offices. So, but as I say, you know, I love that challenge. And I think also someone that's slightly time restrained, you know, the idea of pulling together something in 60 hours, you know, preparation does go into it beforehand. You know, we know who's going to be cast, and, you know, I've kind of got ideas in mind, but, you know, there is a lot of creative problem solving that's done on that weekend. And I guess for people that want to get involved with the production side of things, I say, just, you know, go out and do it. You know, you don't know what you can achieve until you try. And a lot of people probably say that we're really crazy, you can never do that, and somehow it comes off.
I look back on some of these things and I can't even remember how we pulled it off. I don't understand how we did it. And I have to name drop Alexandra Katagida, who she gets involved in a lot of productions, and she's one of the most professional people I have ever worked with in my life. And one of those people that is just lives and breathes theatre.
Right.
And one of those people that during the pandemic was giving up their time for other production companies. And it all felt part of a family. That's what it felt like.
Yeah. No, it's nice. It's nice to hear. It's good. Yeah. And I think it showed. It showed in the stuff that was being produced. That's actually really good. So can I just step back again, just real quick, and just, because you've mentioned the 60-hour Shakespeare, I don't think I gave it enough airtime when, you know, 10 minutes ago when it first came up. The idea I love, right? I think the concept and the challenge for the actors and both yourselves to create a show in that time frame, in that manner. How have you kind of married that with or balanced that against just not having 3 months to just dig real deep and to like play around with stuff and to throw stuff at a wall, and if it sticks, keep it? I mean, I'm presuming you're still doing that. I can imagine that does for some actors cause trouble. It does for you guys cause different headaches that I wouldn't have doing a show with, you know, like I say, 3 months worth of time to kind of prep and get everything sorted.
I have to go in believing, like any director, that this is the best version of Hamlet or Romeo and Juliet or Much Ado About Nothing that's ever been made, because if I'm not in it for that, what am I in it for? and you realize that that's the dream, that's what makes you tick, bottom line. But when you go in and you do something like this, you don't go in because it's better as a process. You just go in knowing it's different, and something different is going to fall out of it. And there are a lot of companies out there that use QScripts and rehash Elizabethan theatre practices to varying degrees. And my eyes haven't been totally open up until lately about the extent of what was involved in that. So we've been kind of slowly bleeding in all of those practices as it's developed. And one example of that is just lately having read more and more about QScripts. So the idea that the actors would only get their sides, their lines, and then they'd only just get the cue. And I thought before, I thought, okay, well, yeah, you get a cue line and then you get all of your sides, and actors are really into whatever they have to say and not really the play. But I just hadn't even begun wrapping my head around what it was really like. And last year we were lucky enough, Charlotte and I, to bring Professor Emma Smith onto our YouTube channel for a Q&A, who's at the University of Oxford. And so I asked her, I said, what could I go and read? And she gave me a list of homework that I could go off and do. So I read one book called Shakespeare in Parts, 500 pages long.
A really small text, right?
yeah. Bedtime reading. And I began by reading about what had happened. So they used to have tavern readings. So Shakespeare used to take his latest play and he used to read it out to all of what they called the sharers. Right. So the big players in the company, like Burbage and Kemp and all of that. And I was telling Charlotte about some of this, and she said, we used to do that. We used to go to the pub in London and read the plays. It's just totally the same. So I hadn't even come close, because I read the first chapter, read the second chapter. I got to the third chapter and I dropped the book when I was reading it. I literally dropped the book. So two things that really jumped out at me. One of them was that Shakespeare realized that they had no rehearsals, and we've sort of touched on that, that it, if they were lucky, they got a morning before the performance went up in the afternoon. So that whole kind of, like, you know, 2 hours traffic of our stage. So it used to go up between like 2 and 4 in the afternoon, but every day a different production. So no time to do anything. The acting company would have Burbage with some of the actors who hadn't trained before. And that was the only kind of rehearsal that they might get, or with Shakespeare, but nothing else, nothing like what we see now. So the first thing was, they used to go on stage having one word as their cue, maybe three. So not even a line. And I was like, what? All right. So that's different from what I had in my head. Second thing was, they don't know who it's coming from.
Nice.
Yeah. So Shakespeare looked at this as being a way of making it into a real life kind of reaction, because he didn't get the time to have those rehearsals. So everybody was on edge going onto the stage. They had something called the plot backstage, which was a wooden board by the exits and entrances, but it was just really a really rough breakdown of each of the scenes. So when the actors got their parts, they could kind of guess who it might be coming from or what was going on in the scene, but they really had like nothing. They had nothing going on. But the other thing that really threw me, and this is when I sort of dropped the book, was that not only did he do that, but that he sonically scored the plays, in the sense that if you look at recurring cues, so something like Mercutio, when he dies in Romeo and Juliet, and he's, the line is "your houses," and then he comes back again 3 lines later with "your houses" again, because he's dissing the Capulets and the Montagues. The only cue word that Romeo's got is "houses." So he's likely to come in on the first one, right? So what they could, from what they can tell, and everything that they have, they are saying that they actually had polyphonic sound on the stage, so that Mercutio was saying his final lines as he was dying, and at the same time Romeo was saying his lines on the other side of the stage. So once you actually get into this, there's kind of, it's a it's a dream that hath no bottom, you know, it's just like, it's endless. Yeah. And that is with a situation where we don't know a lot about rehearsals, but this is kind of what they've come up with up until now.
But none of that's making me feel more comfortable about putting a show on this way. All of that makes me just feel more and more scared that what you're doing is like just walking the edge of a cliff for no reason other than the thrill.
Yeah, well, the thrill there, and I think you feel that adrenaline pumping. You know, we don't want to make things too easy for ourselves. We're real pros here, so it's, you know, why would we have a 10-week to prepare costumes and kind of make sure that everyone, you know, no, we live things on the edge, and I think the stakes that you get in the same way that if that character is coming, they've got one shot, they've got this one opportunity, and I think with having that one performance, that's that really key performance. You know, those stakes are high, and I think you get that nervous energy, and you know, it really feels very alive and very visceral, and it doesn't feel like this is the 20th, you know, production in a, you know, a run of 50. And I think that energy is really felt by the audience as well, because again, you know, it's in the name, there's no hiding behind it. 60 hours is in the name. They know it's taken us 60 hours to do, so they don't quite know what they're going to expect either. So
yeah, and a lot of energy in the modern rehearsal process goes into trying to freshen up the rehearsals when you get to week 5 or 6. And I remember listening to Cirian McKellen being interviewed on the radio and saying that the note, the one of the biggest notes that he ever got from a director was surprise yourself. Okay. And to me, that's what this is all about, that there's no way, there's no escape. They are going to be surprised. So the reaction that you're going to get is going to be real. And that thing of being different every night that we all strive for is something that could fall out of doing things this way. So I guess that's really the answer to the question for me.
Right. And how have you found, given the number of productions you have now kind of achieved in this manner, how have you found the response from the actors? Because again, based on my experience, I know there's a number of actors that probably would grasp it and go, Christ, this is how I want to do it. How much fun is this? And how, you know, as you say, kind of like the thrill of being on the edge and kind of taking on this challenge. But I can imagine there's a number of actors who, even with 3 months to prepare, are still, you know, there's still a lot of kind of, I don't use the word anxiety, but kind of like fretfulness, I guess, throughout the whole process, just make sure I'm getting it right. I want it to be perfect. I want my character to have as much backstory as possible. I want time to develop this, that, and the other, and the nuances of that. How have you kind of found that the actors have taken to it or not?
A lot of the actors have kind of just easily fallen into it, and they all say, oh, it's a play. It's called a play. That's what we're here for. So and this might answer a different question later on, but as a director, for me, a lot of it is about stripping away all of that anxiety and saying to them, I don't care what ends up on the stage at the very end, as long as it looks like it's real.
Okay.
I had to learn a long time ago to let go of what I wanted or what I might have in my head, because at the end of the day, you're making lightning. And you can never recreate something that you get. I always remember last summer with Romeo and Juliet, and we were very lucky to have Colin Hurley in our production, and working with him and just using, you know, like Cicely Berry's sort of displacement things. So having things that they can play with in the scene. So we had some wooden blocks, we had crayons, and we had that scene between Capulet and Juliet, with Capulet saying, you know, like work, tide, time, place. And the first time they went on, we had what we called it the death blanket, because we hired costumes from the Royal Shakespeare Company, but they couldn't touch the ground. So I had to get this blanket for everyone to die on. So when we were rehearsing, I hid things in the blanket, and they didn't know what was going to be in the blanket until they went on and they opened it up. And the first time they went on, Annie Hammond, who was playing Juliet, opened it up and she saw the wooden blocks in there. So the sort of toy blocks that you might imagine a child to play with. And she started to play with them before Capulet came into the scene. And as soon as he came into the scene, she didn't want him to get anywhere near them. And it became really, really tense between them. And Annie, I was talking to her about it the other night. She had a real visceral reaction to it. She actually felt like it was happening to her. And I always, and this is indelibly in my head, I remember Colin grabbing hold of the blocks and just dropping them on each other and saying time, tide, work, place, and seeing the sawdust fly off them. And at the end of that scene, I remember Colin turning to me and saying, so the blocks are staying then. And I have that thing of always wanting to kind of take anything away that you get used to. But I also realized I could never recreate that moment. So you have to approach everyone differently.
Yeah.
There's no way that you can play it the same with everybody. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that we always say there's really only one thing that I really need is that everybody is off book by the time we get to the start of rehearsals.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And there have been one or two times where they haven't been. But I have to create, and one of the biggest things as a director is I have to create a space where everybody feels safe. So I would never talk about who that might have been or anything like that. But it brings its own difficulties when you get to a 3-day weekend of rehearsals and some of the actors don't know their lines at the beginning. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
No, I can imagine, definitely. Yeah. It's a stumbling block when you try and get it halfway through, like I say, a long rehearsal process. So if you've got 3 days when they arrive to really push through to get to a performance and they don't know their lines, yeah, you're definitely going to have a fight on your hands. Okay, brilliant. Each of these questions is pushing me and us closer to talking about the creation of the show. So I guess if we can just kick off and maybe have your input on the selection of a play, what goes into like this, finding the script, maybe editing the script, given it is Shakespeare, whether you do edit or not, kind of what you guys are doing in the background before you even like go out to the world and try and find some actors.
So it all begins with me really feeling like I have a need to get under the skin of a play, and that's usually with a one line or something that jumps out at me that I can't get out of my head. And spinning out of that usually ends up with me looking for something that I can kind of free associate with that. So looking for the imaginary circumstances. And one of the things that has really hit me more and more as we've been involved in more and more productions is the specificity of it. So I don't always necessarily come up with it from the get-go, and it's something that Charlotte and I usually have to kind of hash out between us. But Hamlet, if we kind of rewind all the way back to the beginning, was because I really like The Catcher in the Rye. And I remember I read an essay from the 1950s by an author called Clinton W. Trowbridge, who compared Holden Caulfield to Hamlet. And there are a lot of ways that's just off the chain, that's not even close to who the characters are. But there are some associations that I could kind of believe in and begin to ground things in. And visually, it makes a difference too. If you've got an aesthetic, so Holden left his fencing foils on the subway and that plays into Hamlet. And I was looking for a way of recreating that. So I looked to 1949 because of Catcher in the Rye. And there happens to be a Wittenberg University in Ohio. So that kind of all fell into place. But the thing that really made a difference to Hamlet was not just the specificity of the circumstances. So having a very specific year, like 1949, that Charlotte can begin to sort of play around with and use that as the grounding for all of the aesthetic. But for me also, it has to be something that doesn't get in the way of the play. I'm only in it because of what Shakespeare reveals about character. Okay. And if it becomes anything else, you're laying waste to what was there before.
So the staging of it, if I'm understanding you correctly, doesn't act as like, because I know there's a lot of people always say like, well, not always, some people say like costume is an additional character in the play, or staging is an additional character in the play, or you're not going to be reliant on that as something that is going to be something that particularly drives your ideas forward. You are reliant more on the text than maybe others are.
Yes. But having said that, that to me, there's always something that has to hit the audience in the face that is relatable. You're not going to put up every Shakespeare production as a period production. It's something that we did with Richard II, for example. But with Hamlet and with other productions, for me, it's that Hitchcockian thing of, if you want the audience to get something, you have to remind them of what it is you want them to get at least three times. So if you've got something really visual that jumps out, for example, with the we created these t-shirts for the Hamlet production, which was Wittenberg University Fencing Club, and all anybody ever has to do is see the t-shirt and they're like, oh, okay, I get it. So the simpler it can be, the better. But there've definitely been times where Charlotte and I have not got it to begin with. We've had to really kick it around for a long time before it settled down. And other times where from the very get-go, I've realized the way I want to play it. It was the same with Much Ado About Nothing, which was our very first production. And I just realized that I wanted to do it in 1983 because it fit with the Greenham Common protest and nuclear disarmament. So we did it around CND. We did it around the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. But they've not all been like that. And Charlotte has been the mild inspiration for a lot of what's happened with the way things have ended up being, like Black and White with Twelfth Night or with The Candlelight. But that's just my side of it as director. And as I said before, Charlotte brings all these different kinds of things visually. So her insight is something that I'm really curious to listen to.
Before I let you jump in, Charlotte, can I just ask one follow-up question just before I give you free rein to roll on with that? Is it just so I kind of get my head around relating it to maybe my process or other people listening it related to their process? Are you reading Shakespeare and just then something lands, like you know, are you constantly returning to it for ideas because you know you want to put on a show, or are you just waiting for an inspiration to land and then you seek the play out and kind of do it just to refine that idea? And whether it could just be whatever, but I'm just wondering if you have Shakespeare and the plays milling around your desks in your head and kind of like in your general day-to-day world, and then things are jumping out at you and you're like grabbing them when they fly out the page or whatever.
Yeah, so we have our regular Shakespeare play reading sessions, and we have an open mic night too as part of what we do. So
it's called Shakespeare Sessions, right? It literally is called Shakespeare Sessions.
Yes, yeah. So some of it falls out of that. So someone might come to open mic and do something in a way that I've never seen it before, and it really blindsides me, and I begin to get intrigued in that play, and I go off and read it. Sometimes it's because we've read the first quarto of a play. At the moment, we're looking at the early quartos of the plays and not the folio versions. And if it brings something totally different from what you've seen before. But usually it's because there's a play that I really want to direct, and I've had it in my head that I want to direct it for a long time, and I'm looking for a way in. And there is something about that play that is my way in. But when I say I'm looking for a way in, what I'm saying is I'm looking for a way to stage it after that. But it begins with, I really need to direct this play.
Right. Okay, cool. Okay. Sorry, shall I?
That was a good segue, because I think, again, I talked a little bit about at the beginning, you know, in the partnership that we have, and, you know, we both bring very different things to the table. And, you know, from my perspective as a producer, and obviously with the restrictions of sort of 60 hours, you know, for me, I as a producer, you think about the audience and the people that are coming to see the production. And that's really where I get involved. And, you know, we have these constraints and these restrictions, but it's, you know, how do we make this into a production that really works, and how does it look good? And Gavin will always be about the acting and the, you know, and the quality of what we're producing. And I say, you know, have we thought about how this looks and, you know, that looks? And I think that collaborative process of us both kind of challenging each other and elevating each other, it works really, really well, because you do need someone that can look at it, you know, from the outside and say, actually, you know, this is how we need to position it, or something along those lines. So from my perspective, I know that we have a restriction of 60 hours, you know, we have a restriction of it being an outdoor production, but kind of by collaborating and, you know, Gavin coming to me and being like, I really want to do this play, or I've had this idea milling around. I mean, I normally then go away. I don't bring out a spreadsheet yet. I bring out a presentation and I start doing lots of research, and I, you know, get, you know, a whole compilation of pictures, of imagery, of things that I've seen of other productions. And then I kind of look through that and say, okay, well, what can we take, you know, out of this, and how can we bring this production to life with the 60-hour restriction? And it's a wonderful process. And from that, you know, sometimes we'll just be sitting in, you know, a pub and, you know, thinking about the ideas, and then something will come out of, you know, do we want to make Horatio female, or, you know, or do we want to do this production in black and white? And, you know, we sort of spitball those ideas, and then, you know, it comes to life. And there's no doubt there's sometimes at the end of the show and we sort of say, oh gosh, you know, we'd love to do this again. And, you know, if we did it next time, we do it this way and that way. But I think that's all of theatre. You know, you're constantly reviewing and evaluating and elevating what you do.
I guess and that collaboration sounds amazing. Like, it does sound like, you know, you're very lucky to have found each other in kind of in this manner. It seems that you both have a natural kind of, you do have an understanding of the constraints.
We have to, because everything that we do all goes to charity. So we don't make any money out of this. So, and we're lucky enough to have one sponsor. But a lot of it comes down to me and us being really careful with the budget that we have, and being within that. But it also, that thing of the relationship between Charlotte and I is that we are, it feels like we have that professional relationship of being in a theatre company, but we're also friends. Mm-hmm. To the extent that we can really call it as we see it with each other. And that's a really tight relationship to have.
Yeah, that makes sense. And again, it does sounds healthy, and it sounds, you know, useful in terms of the dynamic that you've set up for yourselves in the company. So that's great. And so just, Charlotte, from that production stance, are you allowing yourself kind of a specific amount of kind of, or you allow, okay, I don't know, this sounds a bit weird, but are you allowing Gavin a certain amount of freedom up to a certain point, or are you kind of in the back of your head already kind of saying, he's going to say this, but I know that we're not going to, you know. I'm trying to get a vision of, like, in the collaborative process, I know things can go awry, and you've really well, you've described really well that actually, because of your relationship and the bond you have, and you know, the fact that you've got a budget that you need to conform to. But I kind of guess I'm looking to try and map it onto someone who's producing a show maybe outside of the constraints that you guys have, and what triggers they should be looking out for, or markers they should be looking out for, that just will help them stay within the lines of sense.
I really think when you approach a production, you have to have a respect for the audience. And that is my role as a producer. Like, that, I wouldn't expect the director necessarily to be thinking of, you know, they're thinking about how are they going to stage this? How are they going to bring something new to the table? How are they going to elevate the acting? Whereas the producer needs to come in and kind of have that in mind. So when, you know, Gavin and I are hashing out ideas and talking about, you know, what we'd like to do, you know, I already kind of have that in my head of, and also from the experience of doing it before. I mean, it was very different the first Much when we did Much Ado, because we'd never really done something to that scale. We'd never worked in that sort of space, but we're getting better at this because we've done it more times. So immediately I'm kind of clocking onto that. And then I have the logistical, you know, challenges of, you know, how are we going to stage this? So it is a, you know, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't just seem like that, you know, everything we strive to do is professional. So, you know, how do we elevate that? And, you know, one of the more recent challenges is been looking at, you know, the budget that we do have. And it's like, you know, what do we prioritize here?
Yeah,
we would love to have, you know, everyone in chainmail, or, you know, we would love to ship this in from there. And, you know, but what are the priorities and what is going to really elevate the performance? And actually that I think has been wonderful for me as a producer is, you know, actually with those constraints is realizing what you can achieve in the same way that as a director, you know, you realize how much you can get out of actors within 60 hours. And as a performer, you realize, you know, how much you can achieve within that time. So in some ways we've sort of set a tough gig for ourselves because we've sort of shown that we can do it. So we know we can. So it's like, okay, all right. So we're used to doing it on small budgets and kind of elevating it. But and there is always there's challenges, you know. I try and get as much information about the actors, you know, I see photos and things, so I've already kind of got in mind, you know, how we're going to dress them and what we'll do. But there is always that element of, you know, me running around like a headless chicken at some point, you know, trying to, oh gosh, you know, we need another, you know, 150 flyers, you know, or oh my goodness, we forgot about a glove. How can anyone think of, you know, forget about a glove? But again, I think, you know, speaking to other costume directors, you know, or producers or anything, there's probably that same element, you know, before any show.
Definitely.
On the West End, there's always some mild panic. So, you know, and I think, you know, I think some people are really surprised when they come and see it. You know, they should be surprised, but they are surprised when they see it. You know, and I think one of the feedbacks we got for Hamlet was like, oh, you know, the costumes were absolutely marvelous. You know, you wouldn't have expected that actually that was sitting under someone's bed and, you know, it was probably using, you know, and that's the, you know, the joy of theatre. You know, it's, you know, you're creating an environment and, you know, it's a suspension of disbelief.
Cool. So let's move on to the big one then. The rehearsals is a process for bringing both the characters alive and the text alive. What in this really refined nature of 60 hours, how the hell do you go about making sure that you're hitting all those marks in the time that you've got? And I presume, again, all of what we've talked about has clearly alluded to the fact that you guys are doing a shedload of work to make sure you understand the text that you're using, and again, not particularly a fully refined vision of what will be staged, but you really have a grasp of kind of like what's being said and why it's being said and how it, what matters in these kind of scenes. How does that play out like point by point when you're doing it in 60 hours?
You have to be totally on top of it. You can't go in with anything less than having the play in your head inside out.
Right.
Visually, you might have the actors play around with it, but the thing I always come back to is that sense of what the actors need anyway, of telling them this is the sandbox and this is what you get to play in.
Right. So you're saying there is parameters, but there's a freedom within those parameters.
Yeah. Okay. Because without that you just get lost. So, and the other thing that really matters to me, if I can pull it off and not always, is having the continuity of going from beginning and end, beginning to end through the play. So that thing of Steven Spielberg with The Extraterrestrial, of having directed the film from beginning to end so that he got that emotional continuity,
right?
Especially with the child actors that he was working with. But to me, that makes a huge difference in any rehearsal process, is that you can see the play. And also that the very, very beginning, we haven't always been able to do this, but it's something that I want to be able to pull off if I can, and we have a lot of the time, is as soon as all of the cast get together, we do a total run of the play without any direction, without anything. And I'm not talking about reading the play. I'm talking about actually full on acting and just seeing what happens.
And that works because they're in theory off book. So that's actually quite nice, because there is that constraint within the world that I operate in, that it's going to take you 3 weeks until you've set that deadline for being off book. So you're still, they're allowed to hide behind their scripts. They're allowed to sort of stand still and not really think about where they should be moving, but actually coming to the first day off book is like massive, right?
Yeah, and sometimes you get the biggest revelations from doing that when you haven't kind of dropped anything on it at that time, and they get to just riff on it and see what happens. Yeah, so that's the big thing for me, that you have a beginning, you have a middle and an end, you have that sandbox, but within that you just play. And this is more of a question of how I direct, really, I guess, but I always have to just give them something to play with. So whether that's if you're looking at something like Meisner or Stanislavski, and the particularization of having an activity that you have to put all of your attention on, or whether you're talking about something like displacement strategies from Cicely Berry, they all come down to the same thing in the end, which is to really problem solve the scene. So right. you're playing with it, but you're playing within some rules. And it's not a question of let's see if we can get across the stage without touching the floor. It's doing that so that we can actually learn something about the character and to deconstruct that scene and to understand what's going on. So you have to have kind of painting by numbers to fit everything into the 60 hours. Mm-hmm. If you've got that and that's all, you've got that down, within that you can do whatever the hell you like. And what you end up with might not be the best thing that happens that weekend, but it will feel like it's happening for the first time.
Right. Okay. And is that where it sounds like you've embraced the fear of that, because I can, you know, if you've removed that, whether it's the word pressure is the correct one, but if you've removed that burden / pressure of what, I mean, again, I've seen a few of your productions now, and they've all been really good. So clearly some of this, all of this is working to your benefit. But as an actor who's done other stuff in the past and, you know, has been able to kind of had a little bit more time to talk it through and stuff, there must be a fear that, you know, you're not giving me enough time. We've not spent enough time on act one, scene six for me to want to move on now. What, you know, is it just, don't worry, I know we've done this enough for me to realize, and you and Charlotte are kind of look at each other and give each other a nod, yes, we can move on? Or is it kind of like okay, this guy's not happy with how his character is working in this scene, okay, we'll give him another certain amount of time?
I look to kind of create some latitude within the rehearsal schedule from beginning to end, so that we have what I already talked about. We have a scene that we rehearse for an hour, we move on to the next one, we get through the entire play. And at the very end, to have another chance to go through all of the play from beginning to end and okay. have a technical rehearsal, so that we get a chance to just play around with each scene. But we also know, and the actors know, that they're going to get one or at least usually two shots at it before we actually get to what the audience is going to see.
Okay. And are you, I guess, Charlotte, direct towards you, but are you, as Gavin kind of works within this works within the framework that you guys have created, are you kind of looking and going and not playing, what's the word, kind of like nurturing mother, where you know, an actor's finish a scene and you're kind of on the side going, don't worry, we got this, we'll be back, we can revisit this as Gavin kind of continues on with the next scene and the group of people? Or how is the dynamic kind of working where, and again, Gavin, you can also just correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm presuming you're very aware that you do have to keep the energy flowing, and therefore you will have to move on at some point to do various things within the time frame you've got. I guess from your perspective, Charlotte, how are you looking at that, and who is playing that kind of person that just reassures the group that
like the mother of the
person. Yeah.
Yeah. I would in some ways say that. I mean, but you know, and we have an amazing trust in each other that, you know, in the method that we do, that we are going to put off, we know we can. But there is, you know, obviously, you know, while we're running, you know, that production, you know, I'm, you know, behind the scenes kind of looking, okay, this is great, this moment is wonderful, maybe that isn't working from a, you know, from an audience perspective, you know, making notes, and we'll have our kind of pep talk and our regroup in between, you know, runs of, you know, what is the feedback. And I think, you know, this could be a very challenging production if there was only one person doing it, but the fact that we're almost both working in tandem and kind of we're trying to hit different marks, you know, we've got it down to a very efficient, you know, process. And you know, there, you know, I think from the producers, you sort of worded it quite well of, you know, who's reassuring, you know, and I'm kind of able, you know, to do that. There will never be questions of, oh, my hem is too long, or, you know, I don't have this. And, you know, it's my job to problem solve and say, this is a priority. We need to sort this out. This doesn't really matter. No one cares about your shoot, you know, sort of thing. And it's that, you know, and there is a high energy to it. And yet it comes together, and, you know, we do, you know, it's not, we're not just doing it once. We do have, you know, 60 hours to do it. So, which is actually quite a long time when you add it all up.
Have you noticed or found a difference between professional actors and amateur actors? And if so, kind of what might that be within this framework?
Well, yeah, it also kind of touches on what we just said about in the one of the things that makes a really big difference to me is that when we're at the venue, when we're not doing a production online, we live, breathe and sleep together. We're at the same digs. We're always around each other. And that's one of the things that makes it so memorable for me. But in relation to having professional actors rather than being professional, there can be amateur actors that do things that you never saw coming, and you can never be able to tell that they're not professional. It's just, for me, it's just, it's a thing of having the same actors in the same space, because I actually believe that we get a lot out of having the professional actors with the amateur actors, that they bring different things, and sometimes they're not that different from one another. It's really hard to have this conversation, isn't it? Because it's hard to tell sometimes what makes, like you said, somebody professional, what makes somebody amateur. I don't know. It's really hard question to answer. But what I will say, and what I always come back to, is I actually feel like we're missing something if we only go for one or the other.
Okay.
And both will surprise you.
Right. Okay, that's a fair comment. Last thing on rehearsals real quick. Character, text, and maybe story. Obviously three key elements to kind of creating a piece. Does one form or does one sit higher than another when you've got this time constraint?
It's the characters. It's the characters, always. It's getting underneath the skin of the character for me. And when you have rehearsals in 3 days, you don't get, maybe that's the thing that you lose, is the with the six weeks of rehearsals, whatever it is, that you don't get to play around with the story in the same way. So because it has to be, but also because that's what I care about, character.
Okay. That's fair enough.
And it's interesting because I say as well, like, obviously, you know, we always strive to put on a very professional production. And, you know, we have often staged, you know, our adaptations in a time period, or there is an element of a backstory. But yet we never want that to get in the way of the, you know, the acting and the performance. And often, you know, a badly staged production can detract from the best acting in the world. So it's interesting you were asking about, you know, the story and the context. And again, I think as we're, you know, developing the play over this period, you know, that is, you know, one thing that, you know, it's almost like we're turning up the dial and down the dial. You know, how much does the story and the setting and the production take place? And you know, where can it be used to kind of enhance what the audience is seeing, but not take away from it? So there have been some things that we've had to completely scrap and just say, no, we're not going to do this. It just gets in the way. It's not working with how this play is evolving. And it's all part of the process, I guess.
And from a, again, just to wrap up and just touch on the shows, you kind of have said a few times, I mean, the pair of you, but Gavin, you quite explicitly said that it's not what that final product is. Now, I'm presuming you have a desire for it to be a quality production that allows punters to walk away with an experience that they remember. But what is your feeling on that? What gets delivered? Is letting go of really what the final product is necessary for you, or are you still kind of quite precious about making sure that the product that you deliver is of a standard?
We talked about what might make actors tick. What makes me tick is going in believing that this is the best Romeo and Juliet that's ever been made, because I'm just going to go home if that's not what I believe in at the beginning. And it sounds ludicrous because we're making it in 60 hours, but anybody that's in theatre and has that heartbeat, that's what they're in it for, isn't it? And it turns out differently every time. But as long as it turns out to be something that the audience is watching and they feel like they're watching Romeo and Juliet, but in a way that they're saying in the back of their heads, is this going to end in the same way that I've seen before? Is this the same play that I've seen before? What's going to happen next? That's what you need.
Yeah, yes. And there is that hot, there is always that hot, slightly heartbreaking moment once you've done it and everyone's like run up on adrenaline. Okay, when is the next performance? When are we going to do it? I want to do the same thing tomorrow. And you're like, oh, it's just a 60-hour
performance. Post-COVID, I guess, where you see your kind of ambitions, but also your dreams of creating new stuff going?
Well, I think there's no doubt, obviously, I think, you know, we enjoyed the world of Zoom theatre much more than I ever expected I would. But we, you know, can't wait to be back in person doing it in the flesh. You know, we did a wonderful production of Romeo and Juliet, you know, outside. And I think everyone coming back together, the energy, and particularly for a 60-hour process, you know, you need to be there in the room with people and you get so much more out of them. And I think, you know, there's really scope to have taken learnings from both sides of things. I mean, I think, as I said, with Zoom, you kind of forced to simplify things, at least on the production side, in the way that could then elevate the acting. And, you know, that's something we want to take back to our productions, because actually when you think of 60 hours as a rehearsal process for the actors, but actually also it's just staging it is a real logistical challenge, and kind of bringing the awareness to it. And you know, I think I don't want to go too much into what we're planning for 2022 because I'm sort of sworn to secrecy, but you know, it's really about, you know, we've done 60 hours online, we've done it, you know, in Reading in Caversham, which has kind of been our home performance ground, but it's now really taking it to new venues and bringing it to new people and also introducing new actors to it, because as Gavin said, not every actor is sort of cut out to be a 60-hour actor, and it's not necessarily through a fault of their own. It's just you need to be of a certain character to be able to do it. And, you know, I think we want to see it, you know, being brought to new places. And, you know, for every actor that's kind of worried, you know, or might be scared about it, you know, we have so many actors that have come out the other side and said, oh my God, like, you know, why have I been rehearsing? Why have I been stressing and spending 12 weeks running lines? You know, you realize how much you can get out of people, you know, if you've got the right environment, you've got the right community, and 60 hours.